And Sue asked me for topics, I threw this one in. Partly because it interests, of course it interests everybody. And I've been a little puzzled why it should get such wide discussion in our day. It seems to me that in the last 10, 20 years, 10, 15 years, it's been such a great subject. The colleges and courses in it almost, and high schools have forums, and I don't remember that this was the case at any time in my lifetime, that the subject in itself has surfaced like that. Some years ago, I was asked by Nelson and Son, the publisher. I had written one book for them in a series, youth series, and they wanted a book on death for young people. And I said, I wonder about that. Why would this interest young people? And then they told me that their findings were that death, that there were two topics that occupied the attention primarily of young people, even junior high people, sex and death, and death probably a little more than sex. And I thought, well, times have changed. When I was young, I like everybody else, I certainly was fascinated by the subject of sex, but I can't remember being preoccupied much with the subject of death. So I began to ask myself why, at this particular juncture, should this subject be of such interest? One possible reason is that in our society, a sophisticated society, we have marooned people from the instance of death. I'd be interested to find out how many of you have seen a person die. You have? Well, a few of you have. It wasn't uncommon at all when I was a child, and even when I was grown. And of course, as a pastor, I've seen a lot of people die under many circumstances, but my parents died in 1948, both of them the same summer, and each time, my mother died first, and a couple months later, my father. We followed the custom that had always been followed, that the body lay in state in the home. So that I remember when the family got together, and mother was lying in her coffin in the living room. And at night, we all went to bed in the old house, in the old family home that had been ours all the time. And I lay there in my bed, and I remember from the time I was young that usually when everybody was just tucked in or had gone to bed, mother would kind of make the rounds, and you'd hear her footfalls as she went from room to room. And I lay there and thought, well, maybe she's doing it again, even though I can't hear her footfalls. And the grandchildren would go through the living room, and there she'd be, and they'd stop and look at her. She died in hospital, and she died quickly, so that we weren't there when she died. But this seemed quite natural. We didn't try to shield any of the grandchildren from death. Well, now in our urban society, a person is whisked off to the hospital to die, and generally the visitation rules are such that nobody can get in there when a person is seriously ill, and except for the very closest people, nobody in the family, very many in the family, would see death. And then off to the mortuary, or the funeral home, and people would come and go in an evening to pay their respects. But rarely any children, of course, or any young people, for that matter. And then a funeral may be attended by very few, and if it's in a mortuary, generally the family is marooned often in some kind of side room, so that they're not going to have to be very close to this. And increasingly now, the actual burial is done at some other time. And I've discovered, too, that there's a growing popularity for having the service in a church, if you have a service in a church, without benefit of the coffin at all, just a memorial service. So that you are shielded from the fact of death. So instead of being an acquaintance, it becomes a mystery over here. And maybe that's part of the reason for the fascination. I really don't know. I remember a friend of mine from Norway said, he said, your Cadillac car has destroyed people's sense of death. In Norway, the burial would be from the church, and then the cemetery might be a mile away, and instead of having a Cadillac car, you'd have six dirty men carry their friend up to the cemetery. When Dr. Rosenthal's wife died, he's a Latvian, a member of our faculty, and so they kind of followed the Latvian practice, and by the time that was over, you knew that someone had died, because we had a service in English in our church at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, like the traditional services that we have. Then in the evening at 7:30, we went to the Latvian service. We didn't understand the language, but it was a long service, about 2 hours. And always the Dr. Rosenthal's and his daughter, he had just one child, sat as far as from here to here from the coffin in the front pew, and the coffin remained open all the time so that they could sit and look at their wife and mother. And the same was true of the Latvian service. And then the next morning, we went back to the Latvian church for a pre-service before the cemetery service. And that was a half an hour or so. And then we got to the cemetery, and again there was a service with the coffin open. And then the coffin was closed at a given time, and the body lowered. And then six friends, dressed in black, friends of Rosenthal's. Seems to me they had formal clothes even, Prince Albert or something. Each with a spade began closing up the grave. And while they were doing that, or just before they did that, each person would come, who wanted to, would come up to the grave, take some dirt, and drop it in the grave. And I whispered to someone, I said, do you think Rosenthal's would like me to do that too? And he said, yes, I know he would. So it was kind of a tribute. Instead of throwing roses, you threw a little dirt. And then when it was all, when they were all through filling it, making a mound, then they made the sign of the cross with a spade on the dirt, and then they put a wreath in the form of a cross on the grave. Oh, this took a lot of time, so there was just no doubt that somebody had died. You know, you had not been isolated from this. You'd really been kind of inundated by it. Well, I don't know which is the better way, and I have no great quarrel with various types of funeral procedures. I've always been a little irked by my friends, the mortician, having a room off to the side so that the family can't and can't have the pleasure of, or we can't have the pleasure of weeping with those who weep. They're off there somewhere. I think it would be better for the family of God to sit together at a time like that. Well, that's an aside, but I say I think maybe part of it, the preoccupation with death, is that we've isolated that whole tremendous significant part of human existence.
What is the significance, as you see it, of having the casket open during the worship service?
I guess I'd prefer not to. Now, this Latvian custom was to have it open. I prefer not.
What are the implications, as you see it, then, of some people choosing to have the casket open, some choosing to have it?
I guess I don't see anything very profound there. I would say, just as a person desires, maybe there's some deeper significance, but I'd be hard driven to find something, I think. Another circumstance I thought, while individually, we live longer than they did in the pioneer days, for instance. I remember reading the biography of Knute Nelson, one of our early senators from Minnesota. He had three little daughters who died the same week from scarlet fever, and this wasn't uncommon. And a week or two ago, I was back in South Dakota, and a couple of my grandchildren, one 10 and one 13, hadn't been there, and they wanted to know where I came from, and where my father and grandfather had lived, and where their father had played as a boy. And we spent, I suppose, an hour in the old cemetery, where I've got five great-grandparents and four grandparents and uncles and aunts and cousins buried. And I was just fascinated by Paul, who's 10 or 11, how interested he was to know to whom he belonged. And that cemetery was kind of a focus for that. That church is, for me, of course, is kind of the mother church. I can sit in that church and look out the window. They don't have, they don't block the vision. They have windows like this. And I can look there at the cemetery. And there's something rather wonderful about that. Now, I don't know what it is. But anyway, in the early days, I guess I was digressed because there were so many markers in that old cemetery of kids who had died. And that doesn't happen now much, except by accidents, and occasionally by a disease that hits them. But we live much longer. But at the same time, we're aware of the possibility of some catastrophic death. Is the planet going to continue? Are we dealing with death, the death of the whole business? And I thought maybe that's part of the reason for becoming intrigued with the question of death and dying. In any event, it's here, or it has been here. Maybe it's a come and go subject. Dr. Kubler-Ross has, of course, the Swiss doctor, this lady, with her books and her lectures. I haven't met her, but I've heard lecture over. Any of you have seen her or heard her? You have. Well, I heard her lecture and I thought, well, and read her book, and I there's nothing particularly new about that, but she's put it together very well. And then her voice is so warm. She's just such a warm person that that's a part of it, I think. But anyway, I tried to write the book. Well, I did write the book, and Appointment with Death. But I discovered that I wasn't writing much for kids. Especially for kids. I was writing for everybody, I guess, because I couldn't isolate this and make it a youth approach. Another factor, maybe, is the increase in suicides and the increase among even junior high and high school kids. Now, whether that means that there's a kind of a heavy, heavy weight, as I talked about yesterday, hanging over us as a society, which did not hang over us 50 years ago, that's another possibility. Well, in the book, I guess I dealt more with not getting set for death, particularly, as much as dealing with the death of someone who was dear to you. I'm not sure that we should spend a lot of time getting set for death. I know I might die in the next minute if my heart would suddenly stop. But to live day by day as if my heart's going to stop the next minute would be kind of bad. And so I think the question of one's death ought to be pushed back a ways and not be such a preoccupation. And there's certain practical things. If a person is and we're all dying, I remember that. Where is it, Longfellow's Psalm of Life? Life is long and our hearts, though stout and brave, still, like muffled drums, are beating funeral marches to the grave. And you're on the way. There's just no escaping that. I guess I have to say at my age now, having almost reached 70, that I say, well, if I remain well, I just soon hang on a while. But really, I ought not to ask for any more dividends. And my greater fear now is to live too long.
Yes, I think so too.
Yeah.
When you pass that 80.
Yeah.
Every day is an extra blessing from the Lord.
Yeah, if you can see and hear and think,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
not have
and
pain.
And be busy.
Yeah.
Well, you can tolerate the pain.
Oh, you can tolerate some of that, yeah.
But I just lost a son.
Oh, did you?
At the age of 52.
Yeah, well, that's...
And here I go on living.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's about my own death, getting set for. I think about the only practical thing I can do now is to make a will, which I did some years ago. There won't be much to distribute, but at least they won't quarrel over the crumbs anyway. Anyway, but this making of a will is kind of intriguing. Because I tried to get some money for the seminary, which has been part of my business for 20 years, from an old bachelor out in the West, out in Montana. And he was over 70, and his pastor said he's got a lot of money. His ranch is probably worth $1 million. And he said, I've been trying to interest him in giving it away or making a will. So I stopped there, and he lived in a 3-room house with no plumbing, a little shack. and cooked his own coffee and, you know, just kind of batched it out there. Born in Norway. And a very interesting fellow. And I visited him several times in route somewhere. And one time, about the second or third time, I felt I knew him well enough now, and we talked frankly now. So I said, let me ask you, you have a will, don't you? No. He said, I don't have a will. I said, don't you think you ought to make a will? Then he got up out of his chair and danced around the room and said, I'm pretty frisky yet. And some of those old poor birds figured that if they made a will, the Lord would say, well, now you can come. And they weren't gonna, you know, remove the last hurdle. They were gonna hold it. But I think now that's pretty well taken care of. Everybody's making wills, most everybody. And that's a practical thing. Now, the over-dramatization, I think, between, let's say that I am dying, let's say I have terminal stuff, and I'm dying, and my family's coming day by day to see me. Now, that's a situation that may lead to some very maudlin stuff, unless you watch it. I had a friend. He was a lawyer, some over 60. He lived alone in a big house, and he didn't belong to my church, but we got to be good friends. And his wife had divorced him, and one of his two sons had been killed in the war, and he was there alone. He called me one day and he said, Al, I want to see you. So I came over. He said, I've just come back from the doctor and he tells me I have 6 months to live. And he said, I want you to know, and I want the doctor to know, and I will know, the three of us will know. I don't want my sister to know, she's living next door. I don't want my son to know, I don't want anybody to know, but us. And then he said, I'm not afraid to die, but I'm afraid to meet God, and you've got to help me. And we spent a lot of time together, and of course his sister and his son knew this very quickly, whether anybody told them or not, they were aware of this. And it was a very interesting stretch. He died about on schedule, and he'd been brought up in some church, but he hadn't had it put together, and he said, I've never believed in purgatory, but one thing is sure, God's got to clean me out before he can take me in. So this business of the freedom of the grace and gospel became the issue. And he was always asking me, what should I do? He said, he'd been a drinker, some drinker, and now with pain, he was drinking quite heavily. And he said, Al, just what's the difference between all this morphine and whiskey? Which is, you know, there's one wrong and there's one right. And I said, John, I don't know. I'm trying to think of something. And I said, don't you have a bigger hangover from whiskey than you do from morphine? That's about the only moral issue I could think of. And the last thing he did, he stopped going to the office and did nothing, but once a week he did go down to his poker club and play a little poker with the boys. And one day he said, you think God wants me to quit poker? Oh, I said, I don't think God cares a whit whether you play poker or not. He was trying, he was just trying to get to do something to qualify for meeting God. And when it broke through that he didn't do anything, somebody had done it for him, it was just like dawn bursting. It was marvelous, really. And here he'd lived for 60, some years in a Christian community and been brought up in a Sunday school. But I think of the last time I visited him at the hospital, I was on one side of his bed, and his son and his sister was on the other side of the bed. It's just a, I suppose, a matter of hours before he died. And he took my hand, and he looked out of the corner of his eye to his sister and his son. And then he gave me a broad wink, as if we'd pulled it off. Of course, they all knew it, but they didn't want to risk the kind of, what would I say, saccharine, mushy, sweepy stuff. So they pretended that life was going on, but they were all set for it. You know, it wasn't as if they were closing their eyes to it either. As far as he was set. He had his material things in order, and he had his spiritual issues in order. He was ready to go. So I never felt that it was very important that they hadn't faced it. They kind of joked till the end. And I'll bet God was kind of pleased with that. Now, that wouldn't be the case with everyone, and I wouldn't design it that way. But to prepare for it and to have an open, you know, talk about it may not always be necessary in the most intimate circles. Now, I have no cure for that. I know the recommendation is that you get it out on the table quickly, and everybody have a chance to talk about it, and the person who's dying, finally getting over his shock and over his anger and over his bargaining with God and all of that, and becoming kind of reconciled. I've seen cases where that's marvelous too, and where you have no trouble. Now, I guess that's probably the way I would want to go. I'd hate to think that my family and I would have to hide this behind a door and not have the courage and the spiritual resources to talk about it if and when it comes. Well, let me shift and talk about grief, rather. What do you do when somebody else dies? Because that's where I, well, let me say one other thing. The question of whether a person has a right to die with dignity is surfacing for us. And I'm sure that euthanasia will be a bigger than abortion in time. And I don't know how it's going to come, it's already come, but when I walk into some of these retirement homes, or not, at least those who have become almost totally incapacitated, as I did here a couple of weeks ago when I called on a couple of my aunts. They were in pretty good shape, but sitting in wheelchairs or lying in beds were a number of people who, you know, wouldn't know their nearest and dearest. They just kind of loll around, and society is going to face this one, at least already, of course. How do you stop treatment? And that's, you know, the tubes are being pulled. I think the doctors, somebody has said that the doctors have an idolatry of life, or we all have an idol just to keep life going. The inverse side of that, as far as the doctor is concerned, is what I think is a really kind of a noble strain in the whole profession. They're fighting to keep life, just fighting to keep life, as if that's, and that's what they're dedicated to. It'd be a shame if the doctors were pretty cavalier about this. They're like very competitive basketball players, hating to lose a game. But the issue of dying with dignity, and it struck me when Pip Van Dusen, the president of, former president of Union Seminary in New York, whom I knew, when Pip and his wife decided to die with court dignity and did their suicide. When Pip and his wife decided to die with cold dignity and did their suicide, that's called suicide, but they can use a gun or hide behind some place and drink poison. But they deliberately took their lives. And you read about that. And I guess everything in me says no, you don't do that. As everything within me says no over against the whole abortion business. And then, but I, what's the alternative? Pip Van Dusen had always, apparently always thought it was right, that he had a right to do this. That within the great command of love, that, He was doing an act of love to those who would have to care for him, and those who for whom he would be a burden. And in the last thing he wrote, you know, on the little note was, "O Christ, thou Lamb of God, have mercy." And you know, as if he was entrusting himself to God. Now, just what's going to happen on that front, I don't know. It's going to be a big issue, I think. Well, coming back to grief, I discovered when my parents died that I don't know whether I'd say I grieved. They had lived a full life. Their six children were all grown. And there wasn't anything so extremely sad about that. When my father died, he died second one time, I asked myself as I drove alone in my car 150 miles to rejoin my family, I asked, what difference does it make to me? And suddenly it occurred to me that I couldn't be a boy any longer. There was no one now over against whom I could have the luxury of feeling like a boy. He was old for, you know, 27 years. I
had not even listened to them, and I had just depended on them. And then and that was fun. I discovered I was on the top rung of the ladder of the generation, and it was kind of lonely up there. And that was kind of a sad thing, not to have a mother and a father over against whom I could be a kid. The second thing I observed as time went on, that I missed them most when there was something good that happened to me or to my family, and I wanted to tell them. I wanted to tell somebody about this good thing that had happened. And I knew they could rejoice with those who rejoiced with us. I wasn't so sure that my brothers could always rejoice. They might be a little envious of this good thing that had happened to me and not to them, you know. But here was two people whom I really could tell when something good happened. And so I missed them at that point. But there wasn't that kind of grief. But when our son died, that was a different ball game. And that happened suddenly, 15 years ago, on his way back from England, after having been a student there for 2 years. And we were sitting at home expecting him, because we knew he was on the way. And about 9 o'clock, when he didn't show, we telephoned his grandmother in Decorah, 150 miles away, to find out if he'd been there. Yes, he'd been there. And he had left. He had stopped there. He'd been in great spirits. He stopped there and had supper. Well, at 10 o'clock, Nora just happened, she told me later, just happened to hear the news about an accident that had occurred on 7th Street, the 405th or whatever that state. And very shortly after 10, two cops came to our door and asked if we were Paul's parents. And for 25 years, we had lived without any major sorrow of any kind. You know, when I look back, we've never really had anything to shock us. Everything had kind of gone well. That has gone fine. And suddenly we had to face this. Well, there were certain things I learned then in the days that followed. One was this is a wrenching kind of pain. I said, okay, if the Lord says, man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife and they become one, and there in the new orbit or the new circle that's formed is where greatest joys and greatest sorrows and greatest pain will occur, that I had in effect left the other orbit and made another one and become a part of another one, and there was where pain was. Greater pain than any other place. I also discovered that words didn't help a great deal. That the presence of one another is very important. And I remember one of my dearest friends, the next day, I looked out the window and here he was walking up to, and I knew he lived in Portland. And as soon as somebody had telephoned him, he had hopped a plane to come. With anything he wanted to say, he just wanted to be there. I remember getting a letter from Jerry Pelican, a long-time friend, who simply said, Al, I'm not giving any word. They're not going to carry any cargo. But the time will come when these great words that you use will carry cargo for you. But this period of kind of shock, that word turned out that important. And that was a good lesson. I knew it before. But as a pastor, I'd always been expected to say something. So I don't think I'd been a chatterbox in those kids. And then I thought of the book of Job, you know, where these three friends of his came and sat for 7 days and seven nights because they saw that his grief was great, his sorrow was great. That was very sensitive thing to do, but they weren't very helpful when they finally took off. All they said was, what in the world have you been up to deserve all this? And I found that grief was threatened to be a duty for me. Well, first let me say that I registered anger, real anger, over this. And I asked myself, who am I angry at? And I said, I'm not angry at the truck driver. And Paul's death occurred. He'd had been accustomed to the British traffic. This is the only way we can interpret it. And he drove his car into the city at dusk, got out of the car, walked across the street to see a street sign because he wasn't as familiar with St. Paul as he should be, as others were. And stepping back on the curb, from the curb, stepped in the path of the truck. The truck was driving into the setting sun. So it was just one of the, and he was killed instantly. And so I was angry, but I wasn't angry at the truck driver. I said, are you angry at God? No, I don't think God engineered that. And so I was angry at this fallen order. What Omar Khayyam says, the starry scheme of things entire. Angry. And then it occurred that God was angry at this too, so that he too was mad about this. He didn't want him there so soon, up there, to assign him some other task. He really wanted him down here. And that he sorrowed, and I was awfully glad to have gotten acquainted with a sorrowing God, one who wept at the grave of Lazarus, to have had a cool, calculating engineer up there arranging this accident would not be too pleasant. I was glad to be anthropomorphic in the biblical sense, and have a God who could weep and a God who was angry. I even kind of changed the words in John 3:16. He said God was so indignant with this state of affairs, for his children suffer tragedy and sin and pain and sorrow and death, that he sent his only son to execute a maneuver that would finally end it all. Why he doesn't end it all right now, that I can't answer. And that's the presence of evil. That's just something that I don't want to even fool with. But it helped me to be angry. And I'm still angry at times when I think of that. And I had to shift to some of my pictures of heaven. That it wasn't the place of retirement. That there was. Then I thought, here was this guy who had all kinds of abilities, and in some ways, if you measure Christian devotion and intensity, the best we had in our family, I say, if you're going to make it, there's no chance of doing it. So I said, what in the world? I'm certainly not just playing a harp up there. God will have to put him to work. I don't know what kind of work he's got there. But I said, maybe an evangelistic campaign in hell. I don't know what's going on. But this idea that there was employment, that there in the other part of the empire he was worked too. That helped. But I discovered that, you know, it's kind of funny. He'd been in England for 2 years. He wrote letters, and he was back once. But I was never more preoccupied. I never thought of Paul more than I thought of the other five. And suddenly I was thinking of him all the time. And that bothered me. It bothered me quite a lot, because I said to myself, was I like Jacob, who had Benjamin, or Joseph? And I struggled with that one, I couldn't get myself to say that had it been any one of the other five, it would have been any different. But then I began thinking, and this was a Roman Catholic priest friend of mine called my attention to that. He said, Alan, you've got to watch him so that you don't get so preoccupied with Paul, who's not here, that you kind of overlook those relationships. And the best, and I had the feeling that I couldn't, when I had sorrow lift, and I kind of bad with some semblance of the form of joy. And then I have a backlash, and I suddenly say to myself, well, you can't do that, because if you don't grieve, it means you didn't love him. So grief became kind of a duty. And I had to grieve. Otherwise, it was evident I didn't care for him. It didn't mean much. Well, the great help for me was the book of Hebrews, the 12th chapter, with that tremendous picture, and it emerges out of the 11th, where all these people have lived and died, and now they form a bleacher section, great amphitheater, where seeing you're surrounded by those, that cloud, now get down and run the race. Well, got to thinking, yes, Paul is there, and he cheered me when I drop grief and get running again. And he's not particularly clean. If he is the reason for my not returning to the common life and not enjoying even the world that the Lord has given. So I had him pictured up in the bleachers cheering me on when I dropped the anatomy. That helped a good deal. Of course, you can't get there. Grief is as natural as anything. If you love, you have to risk grieving. I read a little sermon on the death of Colin Stewart. Have you read that? It's in this little book where that charming story of the rabbit. Bunny?
The Way of the Wolf.
The Way of the Wolf, yeah. With Barry Bunny?
What? Barry Bunny.
Yeah. Well, there's a little funeral sermon there. You remember that, Peter? On the death of Colin Stewart. And the text is, "Go now, have sorrow." Jesus' statement to his disciples as he was about to go to Jerusalem and die. Now, this is the hour for sorrow. Go now and have sorrow. And I just love that, because I had been kind of turned off by the church's penchant for celebrating funerals and for making the funerals a triumphant affair. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, really. There's certainly a note of triumph there somewhere. If you believe that God is in charge and that he outsmarts death and claims this person, sure it's triumphant, but there's something wrong in the kind of removing grief, saying it's kind of wrong to grieve, now let's celebrate. About that time, I had a letter from a friend of mine who had attended the funeral of the pastor, who had attended the funeral of another pastor. And all three of us were good friends, classmates. And he wrote to tell me about the funeral. And he said, everybody said it was a triumphant affair, but all I wanted to do was to cry. I thought that was just beautiful. So I decided, you don't fight grief. You let it be. Let it take its place. It's something like having some minor chords among the jubilant majors in a piece of music. It's just too bad if you didn't have it. And grief need not be fought against. It can be entertained as a thing that belongs. Then how to handle memories. Should we tuck all of Paul's artifacts away so that we wouldn't have to be reminded? This is almost as if treat him as if he weren't around. That he ceased to exist, and we didn't believe that. We believed that he had been separated by the Atlantic Ocean. Now he was separated by another kind of ocean, but we all believe that he still existed in a sense, in a fuller way than before. And I discovered in my prayers I couldn't drop his name. God bless Michael, Paul, Stephen, Martha, Peter, Andrew, the six we have. I've never been able to drop his name. And I kind of have a little parenthesis after the prayer. I would say, you know, he doesn't need quite the care of protection that the others do. Don't forget him. And I think the Protestant Church has lost in kind of blocking off. It's not customary for us to pray for the dead. And certainly not ask the dead to intercede for us. Now, I've never gotten myself to ask Paul to pray for me. But I've asked myself why. On earth, I certainly have no hesitance about asking him, please pray for me. Now that he's gone to heaven, why give him unemployment? Why not keep him on the job? But I don't do that. But I have not found it hard to accept my Roman Catholic friend into asking the saints to intercede for them. They don't pray for the saints, after all. You listen to the language. Mary, Mother of God, pray for us. They don't really place the saints between them and God. I suppose that's the danger. That's why we have reacted to that. But we shouldn't. We should be bold enough to go right into the office without consulting any secretaries on the way. Thankfully, secretaries, we ask them, would you please see if we could see the boss? And we figure we have direct access, and the one mediator is Christ. But this whole church triumph, this whole bleacher crowd, this whole celestial company, about the only time we identify with them is in that beautiful part of the communion liturgy. Therefore, with angels and archangels and all the company of heaven, we laud and magnify thy glorious name. There. And when I sing that, and last night when we sang for all the saints, I felt closer to Paul and my faults than I do at other times. And I think it's a sound thing that we belong with them, and that there shouldn't be anything very morbid about that. And the memories, we didn't have any very bad ones. I shouldn't say very bad ones. We just didn't have any bad ones. It's called bad. It had all been okay. But I did say to myself, why in the world didn't I send him money? I think he had my money. But why didn't I send him money and tell him, now fly directly home? He flew to Montreal, and he hitchhiked from Montreal to Detroit. And then he picked up a car from Minnesota Mining and drove it in. And I said, I'd only bought him a ticket, told him to fly directly home. Then it occurred to me that if I had sent him money, he would have done this anyway and saved the money. But he's always been used to hitchhiking and getting around that way. So, and then I thought, Paul, is there something that you've got against me? Is there anything I've got against you that should have been cleared out? I couldn't think of anything particularly. Maybe he had something. But I don't think so. Our channels have been pretty open. But then I thought, if I believe in the overarching forgiveness of God, a kind of forgiveness that swallows everything up, wouldn't it be ridiculous for me, even if there were some things that were festering, wouldn't it be ridiculous of me to let those things bother? When I believe that God forgives and forgets, and now Paul's up there right in his company, and he knows all about this, for us to be entertaining some regrets and remorse and unpleasant memories, and let those memories have teeth in the face of this overwhelming tidal wave of forgiveness we believe in, would be wrong. And that it was my duty to just brush that whole business aside and say, even if we'd had some very horrid things that we hadn't taken care of, as Christians, we'd have to put it all aside and say, well, and I thought, well, I bet you, if anything like that occurs to Paul, he's just chuckling, and I ought to chuckle too. Well, this business of grief. I like this. You remember this account in 2 Samuel about David, where David, as you know, did this terrible thing of seducing another man's wife and killing him, Uriah. And then he and Bathsheba had a child, and the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bore to David, and it became sick. Now that's of course the old way of putting things together. Anything bad, God did it. Anything good, God did it. And if you get blind, you deserve to get blind. If New York City gets blasted with a bomb, New York City deserves it. This kind of justice. But that's the way they operated pretty much in the Old Testament. That's what Job's friends were doing too. David therefore besought God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night upon the ground. And the elders of his house stood beside him to raise him up from the ground, but he would not. Nor did he eat food. On the seventh day, the child died. And the servants of David feared to tell him that the child was dead. For they said, behold, while the child was yet alive, we spoke to him, the king, and he didn't listen. How then can we say to him that the child is dead? He may do himself some harm. But when David saw that his servants were whispering together, David perceived that the child was dead.
And David said to the servants, "Is the child dead?" And they said, "He is dead." Then David arose from the earth and washed and anointed himself and changed his clothes. And he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. He then went to his own house. When he asked, they set food before him, and he ate. And then his servants said to him, "What is this thing that you've done? You fasted and wept for the child while he was alive. But when the child died, you arose and ate food." And David said, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, 'Who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live,' in a bargaining with the Lord. But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." I think that's beautiful. You know, it's over. And when all is said and done, we are a part of a vast empire, and our tenure with life here is short, and we believe that when this is over, that he who raised up Jesus will raise us up, and on our feet again in another and a more wonderful part of the empire. And I discovered that that for me was where grief kind of came to rest. For me, it added a new, another great dimension that he's still there. That is, he's not blown out like a candle. I suppose the bell tells us we ought to go.